namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Occasion, gratitude to Parents Day. Tanjandri Demo has arranged this event, and I have the good fortune of visiting T. Sarana at this time. So it's this is my second. I was here about 4 years ago, and now I've come back for a short visit. And on the 23rd, I fly to Portland, Oregon, to see my sister. So what I like to do is reflect, not kind of preach or tell you what to think, but occasion to, when you, they like the experience of gratitude, isn't something that you can command or make somebody feel. You know, you should be grateful is almost makes it impossible for anyone to feel gratitude. But it's through reflection, you know, through considering the goodness, say, in your life, that which has brought you here, such as our parents, you know. If it weren't for them, we would not be here at this moment. And then we develop this sense of appreciation, gratitude for opportunity to live at this time, and to and then the parents we have, we can reflect on their good qualities, their care, their love, their generosity, all that we remember that's wholesome, good, and beautiful that we remember from living with our parents, being brought up by our parents. Some of your parents are here now, still alive, breathing. Mine passed on about 25 years ago. But I still, whether they're alive or not, you still remember them. So even when your parents die, you have this, you still remember and think of them. And so in a Buddhist country like Thailand, of course, it's a society based on this, on expressing gratitude for the goodness that we've been offered in this life through parents, through teachers, through friends, through politicians or whoever, monks, whatever. And I found this very, you know, such a beautiful way to use my mind to reflect on the goodness of life, rather than feeling bitter or resentful because everything wasn't, you know, I could easily remember the faults, the flaws, the unpleasant things of life. And I remember Lumpho Cha, when I went to stay with him, he told me, he said, you should reflect on your own goodness. And I hear I was 32 years old at the time, and it never occurred to me to reflect on my own goodness. And, you know, because I was much more aware of my faults, my mistakes, you know, the what I didn't like about myself, I was aware of that, but never consciously acknowledging virtue or goodness as a part of my life. And then I remember thinking, I'm going back to my kuti at that time, I think, I could write lists of what's wrong with me. You know, you ask me what's wrong, I could entertain you the whole day. Then the virtue, I always get embarrassed thinking of myself as virtuous or good. Because somehow that always seemed like you'd get inflated, you know, it'd make you egotistical. But that wasn't Rinpoche's thing. You know, he was aware that you had to acknowledge, why would I be in a Buddhist monastery in northeast Thailand if I was bad? If I like badness, criminal tendencies, and I certainly wouldn't have gone to live with Ajahn Chah. I began to think, I'm basically a virtuous person. I love the good, the true, the beautiful, and that's why I'm here, because of that, not because of my faults or weaknesses, but because of virtue. And it isn't an ego trip, or it doesn't inflate your sense of, I'm so virtuous. Let me tell you how virtuous I am. It's just admitting the truth to yourself. Because, like today, why would you come to a monastery like this? Not to sell drugs or make, mafia agreements on who to do away with next, but because of that very goodness that we have, and that needs to be fully accepted in ourselves too, because in a society, modern society, I found that people are getting depressed and so much because they dwell on what's wrong with them, or what their weaknesses or flaws or defects. And I lived in England for 34 years as a bhikkhu, as a monk, and of course I lived there longer than any other place. And then of course I got to understand, the people. And we had this retreat center in the monastery Amarabati in Hertfordshire, and that became it was always booked up. People were very, very eager to go on meditation retreats. And then on interviews and so forth, you hear how much people are self-disparaging, how aware, how concerned they are about the things they've done wrong in the past, or think they've done wrong, or weaknesses, flaws, or character tendencies. And they were quite upfront about old ease, because that seems to be how modern society works. You're so concerned about what's wrong rather than what's right. With our parents, we think of, in Asia, of course, this is a part of the culture, to feel this kind of oneness and gratitude towards parents, grandparents, relations. But I'm originally from the United States, and my generation, we were never suggested gratitude to parents. And it was all about, perfecting yourself, getting, making yourself better. Americans are really hung up on self-improvement and a competitive society where your worth depends on how you compete and if you win or fail. And it's so self-centered, the result of which makes you feel lonely, because your sole interest has been in yourself rather than, say, with your family or in other things. Now, the human consciousness is one that we're all sharing at this time. It's not a personal thing. Consciousness is universal. It's not culturally biased, racially biased, or anything else. It doesn't have any identity with anything, that's formed or shaped or good or bad, right or wrong. But it's what we're experiencing here in this, at this very time. We're all experiencing consciousness. And then what comes into consciousness at this time can be your own feelings, maybe you're uncomfortable physically, or you're having, you know, you're feeling restless, or emotionally, or you're happy or sad or whatever, but on the level of the different feelings, different conditions, we're all different, you know. What I feel right now is not going to be exactly what you're feeling right now. But this is a suggestion, and regarding consciousness, it's the same for all of us. It's not my consciousness and yours. Then this gives a perspective on a unity, on the universality of consciousness that we begin to recognize. It's a unifying, that's which unifies us rather than the conditions which separate us. Like when you're identifying with your body, then we're separate. You know, I'm here, you're there. It's obvious that I have, you know, in just in time and place, that we have different forms, different shapes, different ages, and they're all different one from another. And then, but in consciousness, I'm not making this doctrinal, believe me, but it's a reflective, a suggestion to see consciousness is we all share that together, and that's unifying. So in the Buddhist teaching, you know, the aim of meditation, they emphasize mindfulness, sati sampajanya, awareness, intuitive awareness, which means that through that alone we can recognize pure consciousness, the unifying, universal intelligence that we may not be aware of, even though it's operating all the time, but we become so involved in our own thoughts, views, opinions, fears, and emotions that we don't notice what's obvious, what's here and now, what is real. So, in like with parents, for example, now mine died in 19 late 80s, and then now I'm in the next month I'll be 80 years old, so I'm getting into that category that my parents reached. My father was actually 91 when he died, but you still remember them, and because of this reflective ability, I remember them with gratitude, because I realize I would not have been able to live like this or have this opportunity if they had not been my parents. And then I reflect on, they were basically very good, they were good Christian people, and they did their very best. And I was born in the middle of the Depression in the 1930s, when the United States was really suffering a lot, and my parents never forgot that depression. You know, they always were afraid that might happen again. But being born in the middle of it, both my sister and I, we didn't really know how much my parents, what they had to do to keep going, and the efforts they made to provide a home and take care of us when there were all this economic depression that my parents would tell us about later on. But my memories of early childhood are happy. I don't. My early childhood, I only think of what I remember was a kind of happiness, discovery of life, and my parents were very kind, and I only remember it as being a pleasant period of my life. I remember suffering began when they sent me to school. That's really what I remember suffering. But in terms of the home life of those early years, I remember it as very pleasant. And I was born in Seattle. It was a hometown, and we lived in a nice parkland area. And of course, when you're growing up, everything is new, so you're walking on paths, and you have this childlike innocence to everything around you, like a flower or a toadstool or whatever, suddenly, you know, something fantastic. So, and my parents encouraged this kind of reflection at that time also. Then they you realize also that so many people have had unfortunate early childhoods, and especially when you're teaching meditation and people tell you some of the things that of their past, you know, what they've endured, all kinds of abuse or mistreatment or lack of attention or love, and so any kind of flaws or criticisms I had from my parents suddenly kind of faded out. They lacked importance because, you know, basically I was well treated, and I'm grateful for that. You know, that makes me feel this gratitude. Gratitude is a it's not something, as I said before, not something I can command. You know, you can't. I can say you should be grateful and to your parents and make it into kind of an intimidating demand on your mind. But actually, my experience of gratitude doesn't come from someone else commanding it, but from reflecting in my own mind. And not making problems about what you think your parents did that wasn't right or what that was wrong or lack of sensitivity or their particular personal problems, but you're reflecting on their goodness. And that takes a kind of interesting determination of mind. You know, and on your own goodness too, to make full it more conscious, your own goodness, your virtuousness, your love of what truth and goodness and fairness and justice and beauty, happiness. And it's not, we can see it in terms of I'm in a kind of pejorative sense of I'm a greedy person or, you know, I've got all this greed for beauty and all that. But that's not it. It's not about criticizing yourself, but acknowledging, honestly, you know, acknowledging the goodness of your life and the goodness of other people, your parents, teachers, friends, husband, wife, families, and all the rest. It's a way of exercising our minds in a skillful way that give us this result is gratitude. And I found in monastic life, like in Buddhist monastic forms, you know, it's a very reflective lifestyle. You know, you have what they call samanasanya. You have these things that you contemplate in your life. Like if you're an alms mendicant, like Ajahn Mirdhamma was saying, you know, we depend for, you know, like food and basic survival things on the kindness and goodness of others. That's the monastic reflection, actually, in the Theravada monastic school. So then you, because we, you know, people are generous, and in Thailand where I'm living now, you know, people always give the very best, and even if you're in a poor area, I've lived in areas of Thailand that people were quite poor, village people in the northeast, and they will always give the best they have. You know, so you reflect on this, on the goodness of this offering. And rather than taking it for granted or criticizing it because maybe it's not what exactly you want, you start reflecting on the goodness of others who make this food available, this occasion available, and so forth. And the result of that, of course, is a kind of joyfulness in life. you know, like selfishness is misery. When you're only thinking about yourself and your own mind, what you want, and then you're criticizing others who get in your way. When you look at that and you observe that in yourself, it is miserable. And it, you know, you can be a monk or a layperson, be anywhere, you know, in a very pleasant holiday resort or wherever you are, you take this with you, you know. So it even in the most wonderful environments, selfishness will make your life miserable. It's something that you contemplate. You can't say you should, you know, to say you shouldn't be selfish is a kind of truism. But you also need to recognize the suffering that comes from selfishness in your own. You know, aren't really worried about other people, but your own attitude of me first or my life at the expense of others is what? What is that like as a mental state? And then in the Buddhist teaching, you open to that. You know, you're not trying to say there's something wrong with it, but you begin to acknowledge it, know it. It's like this, and then you see the unpleasantness of it. And when you see the unpleasantness of it, you let go. It's not because you've been told that you shouldn't have be selfish, but you just know that, you know, to hold on to this attitude, this emotion is misery, and will only create more misery. So that it's a kind of insightful recognition, the result of attachment to this sense of yourself, that you have this insight to let go of it. This is now in the Western world, Buddhism has become, it's a highly regarded religion, even if people don't aren't Buddhists themselves. Like in the UK, you know, generally speaking, Buddhism has a good reputation there in the public press and on the television and whatnot, because it does represent peace and they connect it with good things like non-violence and calm and serenity. And so my life in the UK was not difficult. Being a Buddhist monk there was not, I didn't find it at all difficult coming from the outside, you know, from the government itself, very tolerant towards religion, and I never felt at a disadvantage or looked down on because I was a Buddhist monk. So I appreciate that. I feel grateful for my life in the UK because, you know, I was able to live as an alms mendicant in a country that's not Buddhist. In Thailand, you can take a lot for granted. You know, 95% of the people consider themselves Theravadan Buddhists. So, I mean, the danger in Thailand is taking it for granted. You know, that people are going to recognize you and support. But in my experiment going to England with Ajahn Mirjambo, he went with me. Living in London, we didn't know what was going to happen. In fact, before I even went, I had a period of, you know, getting cold feet. I went to Ajahn Chah and I said, "Lumpur, you know, it's, you know, there are not many Buddhists in England, and you know, here in Thailand, you know, it's okay, but if, you know, walk down the streets of London and in a robe, nobody will know what it is." So I had grave doubts at the time, you know. And Lumpur Cha was very strict on the Vinaya, you know. So you can't have money, you can't hold money, You can't plant your own cabbages or anything. There's no way that you can support yourself through your own efforts. And so we lived in northwest London, in Hampstead, for 2 years, and we used to walk. And the Bhutchar said, go Bindabat every morning. He said, you know, take your alms bowl and walk around Hampstead. And he said, you know, if they don't give you any food, it's okay, just to be seen. So we did that. And of course we lived near this beautiful parkland, Hampstead Heath, which is one of the nicest places in London, and huge parkland area. So we walk up there in the morning, and you know, we didn't get much food really, but but we did get some. And when I was at Amaravati before coming here, we lived in Belsize Park, which is next to Hampstead, and then we used to walk down this Upper Park Road, and at the end of this road was a grocery shop that sold groceries, and they were Sri Lankan, Sinhalese people.
Oh.
And so the first day we went in the bar, the married couple, young married couple, came out, and they were just so amazed, you know, and they gave food every day. and we moved to, you know, after 2 years there, we moved to West Sussex, to Chichester, and I didn't hear of them from that time on till this a couple of weeks ago in Amaravati, when the man, Sheldon De Silva, came and said, you remember me? He came and introduced himself. And so this of course, is reflecting on that. What is the result of reflecting on, like, Sheldon De Silva's? When you don't know what's going to happen, you're not even British, so you feel all kinds of hesitations about living in a huge city like London. But then that generosity that Sheldon De Silva offered was the attitude, is gratitude. You feel a sense of gratitude for that. And you notice that that's a good feeling. That's something to cultivate, not expect people to give you things or demand them, but to, when they do, then it's what you remember, and it uplifts your mind. You feel this sense of joy, gratitude, joy, contentment. Then one time we were coming down Haverstock Hill, and this schoolboy, English schoolboy, stood out on the pavement. And usually schoolboys can be, you know, make fun and say you're skinhead or things like this. I was expecting the worst, but we stopped, and he had his lunch, packed lunch, you know, and he took the apple out and put it in my bowl. And, you know, feel this gratitude is the result of that schoolboy's generosity. And you notice this, like when the Samana Sanya, when we reflect on the goodness of our lives, and, you know, you reflect on that, on these events, the things that where people have come forth without you kind of demanding or even hinting at it, where goodness, kindness is generated towards you, and the feeling that comes from that is what they call katanyu, katavati in Pali, is a gratitude. And this is the foundation of monastic life, gratitude. It's you know, our whole life is based, is, you know, the result, if lived properly, is a sense of gratitude. So, you know, this will be my 48th pancha or vasa this year. And when I ordained, I determined only to do 2 years. And so this will be my 48th. But my sense of gratitude is so strong that you know, you begin to love the life. It's a beautiful way to live your life, whether it's in Thailand or in England or Canada, wherever. And it seems to, like Lumpo Cha's view was that people are basically good. My view, the American view of my generation at least, was people are basically selfish. As I was brought up, you have to look after yourself, otherwise no one else will care. And my parents were very determined that I have life insurance and make sure that I have enough in the bank, and you know, because if you don't, you know, no one will come forth and help. And then Lumpo Cha, when I questioned, you know, whether I could actually survive in a European country as a Buddhist monk, he said, are there kind people in England? And I said, well, I'm sure there are. And he said, go. I didn't say, they're Buddhists. He said, kind people. So my years in England were the experience of basically kind people. You know, the dark side of that society I seldom ever saw, because living there so long, I experienced this generosity, this interest, and caringness from all levels, from the British people themselves, from the Thai, Sri Lankan communities, Cambodian, Lao. They all come to the monastery. And so you're experiencing generosity, kindness, caring. And the result of that is, when you reflect on it, is gratitude. Then the ideal of monastic life is, you know, be content. And of course, the free market capitalist system, it doesn't want any of you to be content. Although the economy would collapse. It wants you always to be discontented, you know. Last year's model is, you know, not as good as this, the latest one, and so forth. So we were brought up in a society that encourages discontentment. And, you know, I'm not criticizing, I'm just pointing that this is very much what we're conditioned with, is this idea of having more, better, and that's how our culture operates. It encourages us to always think there's something better than what we have now. Where in the traditional monastic form, the Buddha, you know, this is established 2,557 years ago in India, and so it's a totally different time, different place. But somehow, due to the wisdom of the Buddha at that time, this particular form has survived up to this very moment. What you're seeing in front of you is actually the result of what the Buddha established in India 2,557 years ago. Well, that says a lot about the wisdom level of the Buddha, because there must have been many other enlightened people at the time, you know, but they never established a form that could be transmitted through time and survive. And so, you know, it's as we call in Pali terms, Bajika Buddhas, enlightened beings who see the truth, realize the truth, but are not able to teach or express it or have anything other than after they pass on, nobody remembers. But the model of the Buddha, the Lord Buddha that was the founder of this tradition, is that he established a conventional form enabled to carry on the teachings and the monastic form that would survive through time. And then when you look at 2,557 years of history in Asia or any other place, it's all, you know, changing feudalism and tribal attitudes and wars and empires and destruction of empires and kingdoms and rising, falling of these different worldly conditions. And somehow, you know, like in this monastic form has survived through all the turmoil that they've had to live through. At one time, you know, Buddhism was the dominant religion throughout Asia. You know, it was everywhere. Now, Afghanistan used to be Buddhist, and then Indonesia and places like that. So, and then gradually it was, you know, through invasions and persecutions, a lot of Buddhism was destroyed, but it's never been completely destroyed. It always has enough left to revive it. And now there's an increasing interest in the West, which never happened before. And I'm very much a result of that, because I became interested in Buddhism in about 1955, and I was in the American Navy, and we were on a cargo ship, sailed from San Francisco to the American bases in Japan, the Sasebo and Yokosuka, and then we sailed around the Pacific. I did that about 9 times, and it was in Japan that I discovered Zen Buddhism, and there's something in me as 21 years old and really responded to that in a way that surprised me, because somehow that approach, the approach of the Buddha, I could relate to almost immediately. And yet I was brought up as a Christian in a kind of privileged society, and where Buddhism was never, you know, we heard of it, but we thought it was little incense burners, fat belly Buddhas. Put incense. It's quaint, you know. Couldn't take it seriously. And then in Japan, you know, then this movement in the 50s of the beat Zen and things like that in San Francisco, there was this kind of fashion, a fad of interest in Zen Buddhism, which has been well recorded in fiction and whatnot. So that was the beginning, you know. Suddenly the West was discovering a different way of thinking, a different way of looking at life. And that appealed to a lot of us, because we found that the cultural conditions of our mind were stifling us. Just the way I would think about things was so black and white, so, you know, it was either right or wrong, good or bad, absolute, you know. So you had this kind of rigidity of a mindset that you knew, intuitively you knew, was there had to be something better than this. If I'm going to live my life with just this kind of thinking and nothing better, life didn't seem worth bothering with. But then Buddhism, as it was transmitted at that time, you know, it was fashionable and oftentimes very foolish, but it had that message, that kind of we picked up on, many of us kind of recognized even though if you'd asked me at that time what it was, I wouldn't have been able to tell you at all. But I knew it kind of intuitively. So since I was 21, I followed that. And that's been my main interest, has been in the Buddha Dhamma. And then in meeting Lumpa Cha in Thailand, I was very fortunate in meeting one of the masters. When I really determined to go the whole way, you know, not just read more books about Buddhism, but to actually try to make it work. And of course, Ajahn Chah was the expert. And then in the life, of course, these samana reflections, you develop gratitude. And that gives you, and it also contentment. You're content with very little. You know, you're not, you can't make yourself content as a willful act. You recognize the suffering of discontentment, thinking it's not good enough, for what you have is something better. If you begin to observe these, the discontentment, not as a criticism, not as something wrong with you, but more just observing discontentment is like this, so you're accepting discontentment, and you can see it's not doesn't lead to happiness or peace. It just makes you want and feel frustrated if you can't get what you want, or envious of people who have better things than you have. And that's not very peaceful, to be envious and want what others have. So in the training of monastic life, then you reflect on these. All you need is a shelter for the night, you know, and the Buddha put this at the lowest possible standard. It's not like, you have to give me a really nice shelter, you know, 5-star accommodation. But it's the root of the tree. That's minimal, isn't it? And in England, that would... In Thailand, it's possible. But it's a reflection, you know, the standard, the four vectors are the lowest standard. For the robes, it's like the katina ceremony when Ajahn Thanajan Redamo, when they enter the Vasa next month, then a 3-month pass, and then the katina. That's the ceremony where the bhikkhus were given permission before that to make robes out of rags, you know, bungzakula cloth, they call it. It's like rag robes or cloth that's thrown away. The villagers don't want it. You know, the stories about going to charnel grounds and taking the cloth off corpses is a pretty gruesome idea, actually. I've never had to do that. And it's the Buddha allowed, you know, we were able to clothe ourselves with the refuse rags of the society. And then in the scripture, the Buddha, you know, the lay people had such respect for the bhikkhus that they came to the Buddha and asked if they could offer good material so the bhikkhus would have better high-quality cloth to make their robes with. And the Buddha gave permission. And that's what is the katina ceremony, the origin of the katina ceremony. But just to emphasize the standard is on rag robes, bungsakula cloth, rags, root of a tree, and then bindabat food, like we went on the rice bindabat. That's a tradition. But it also is a sign of just the food that somebody drops, puts into your alms bowl, so you're not, you know, an idea of demanding the best food, or the Buddha would say, no, you know, you're not supposed to just go to the wealthy people's house or where they have the good cooks. You go to society, whoever wants to offer, you accept it. And then medicine is based on cow's urine. And that's the lowest standard for medicinal treatment. In my life, 48 years, I've never had to resort to that. In England, they have national health system. In Thailand, they have, they're always taking care of monks. And so I have the best health treatments and so forth. But it's not demanded, you know. You can't ask for that, and you don't demand it, because you always feel this gratitude, because you're getting much better than what the lowest standard is. We need that low standard, not as something we've got to hold to, because it would be very, you know, make our lives quite unpleasant, but it's basic. And then, but people, because we're all mendicants, people are offering something better all the time than that. And what happens when you're content with the lowest standard, with bhangsa kula rags, with food dropped into your bowl, with root of a tree or fermented urine, you're always getting better than that. Then what's the result? Is kṛtanya, or gratitude. And you reflect on that, you notice gratitude is a beautiful feeling. It's a joyful feeling. And it's not something based on you, on your own kind of, I've got the high level of concentration and I'm, you know, can take forth jhana now and I'm so good. It's based on reflection, not on attainment. And this is the heart and soul of this monastic form, alms mendicancy, or in Pali they call it samana life. So this is to, you know, encourage you to, if you want joy in your life and contentment, you won't find it by getting more and more, but by reflecting, you know, and being, and finding, you know, and really noticing the goodness that people offer, rather than just dwell on all the wrongs and injustices and unfairness that you can remember also. And in the early years that I was with Lumpa Cha in northeast Thailand, you know, I began to see how much resentment I had, because I was carrying resentment, you know, from my life, not from what I was experiencing there, but from all kinds of things that happened to me before I became a monk. I wasn't always treated fairly or understood or cared for in the way that I should have been. And sometimes people would deliberately, maliciously do something against me, and then you resent and you carry that. And one time I was in my kuti in Wapapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and it was one of the, you know, like the hot season in the northeast, and it's really hot, and you're so lethargic, and you're so bored, you know, you're just so bored with the everything you heat, and then the, and then your mind, and then you try to liven it up with remembering. I started remembering injustices done to me, and I got really wound up into righteous indignation. And then I started reflecting. You know, here I am. It has nothing to do with this monastery. Remembering something that happened to me 20 years previously, and you know, it's nothing to do with the time or the place, except my boredom wanting to, you know, the righteous indignation is a powerful emotion, and you feel you're right, you know, it's not, you can really build yourself up into that one, and it's exciting to feel, you know, I'm not going to stand for that ever. And then, and it did lift me out of the boredom, but it also wasn't a very peaceful state, and it was ridiculous because it had nothing to do with the situation I was in. And that's seen through reflection on why do I do this in a Kuti in Thailand 20 years later, just liven up my emotional state through remembering something that makes me indignant. How many of you do things like that? So, and this is how you begin to understand yourself, you know, why we suffer so much, even in affluent country like Canada or privileged conditions, we can still suffer enormously about resentments of the past and fear and worry about the future, and we create these mental states we're caught into, and then we have to go to a psychotherapist or take to drink or do something, because it is such an unpleasant mental state to be attached to. But with the Buddha's teaching, it's awakening to these what we're doing, to attachment to these conditions, and we and then we have the insight into letting go, and then you'll begin to experience contentment and gratitude. My voice says, Ajahn Sumedho, you better stop.
Handvayang avadagata sattu karang tattamase sattu sattu.